Welcome to the Thrivology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Neil Utterback, that's me, and Phil
Phil Dunwoody. Big awkward pause. Okay, so Neil and I are both faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. And today we're talking about what mindfulness is and what it is not, because there's a lot of misconceptions about it. And we're going to touch on, of course, some of the practice, but I think we'll maybe do another podcast on like a how-to, right, if you're new to it and you want to do it. So this is more why you maybe should consider it, what the research benefits are. And we're going to share also a little bit of our own mindfulness journeys, right? Because it's something you and I, right, we've both gone through training on this. We now teach it as part of our regular coursework. We teach people actually how to do mindfulness meditation. Like for a much longer period, I've been teaching people about the research on mindfulness as a cognitive psychologist. I think in like 1991, the Dalai Lama, along with some neuroscientists, founded the Minded Life Institute and started looking at basically what's the science say, right? And so they started putting Buddhist monks in scanners and giving them attention tests, and so I started teaching about the research quite some time ago, even much longer kind of before I had my own regular practice that would actually be mindfulness meditation.
And where did that come from for you? Like when did that get on your radar? When did you start developing more of a practice for yourself?
So it's kind of a long meandering journey, like many journeys, right? So I've been doing martial arts. I started graduate school in 1996, 97. And that was the time I started martial arts as well. And so in most Asian martial arts tradition, there are meditation components, right? And so in karate, Okinawan karate, which I was doing, there's very much a Zen meditative practice that comes with it. And then in Tai Chi, the practice is called Qigong, right? And Qigong is kind of a generic word in Chinese for meditation. Qi means energy. Gong is the same gong that's in Gong Fu. We say Kung Fu. And it just means that you spend a lot of time developing skill. So it's literally spending time developing skill with energy or focused on your own energy and other people's energy, right? So I had done these things. I'd say I had done things that were mindful-ish. And, you know, close relatives, frankly, right, in the kind of the tree of contemplative practices. And then I started to get more interested in Buddhism, really, I guess, around that same time. But I think it would probably be when I started to actually teach about the research on mindfulness, 2004, 2005, somewhere in there. That then I started to think more about a deliberate practice that was something different from the Qigong or the Zen practice, which again has a lot of overlap, but they are not exactly the same as mindfulness meditation. And then really 2019 is when I like officially went for training in the Kuru program, which I know you've also done. Both Neil and I have a colleague, Susan Prill, who's a religious studies faculty member, and so her and I were doing some kind of research on what other colleges were doing around mindfulness initiatives and living and learning communities. And so it's really probably been the last 5 years that I've had a more deliberate, what would actually be mindfulness meditation and not just close relatives of it.
Well, I think what I'm also hearing, and we'll talk about it more as we get through some of our other points here, and two things that I think is important at the outset is that there isn't one way into this. Talking about that tree of contemplative practices, like I too came through a very disjointed and not sort of any kind of formal arrangement. It has since become the other point that you bring up is the deliberate practice. I'd say like it was probably 5 years of then developing a deliberate practice, and I think roughly probably 5 years or longer where the system I'm using now sort of came into clarity for me, which is really a synthesis of, I'd say, past 15 years or really once I started surfing in 2004, that was really the thing that got me started. as I talked about, like on the last podcast, like starting to recognize the things that are and are not in my control, and how do I discern those things? And that got me into yoga. And a couple years into my surfing journey, I don't know if you and I have been out to Estorillos in Costa Rica. It's a break about 45 minutes from where we go in
Jaco. I don't think I've been to that one.
It's a really nice wave. At the time, it was a little bigger than I was used to. And our surfing friend, David Solano, took me and another surfer out there. And it wasn't terribly big, but it was a little bigger than I was used to, the wave.
I
wiped out, and I didn't have enough air, and I went under, and a wave was right behind it.
Yeah.
And as I was coming to the surface and thinking, I'm going to get some air, the second wave caught me and pushed me back down. And then, as we talk about a lot in class, and you talk about in Tai Chi, I panicked.
Right.
And that panic, I thought it was the end. I didn't, underwater, it wasn't, right? I was probably down there.
It was 2 seconds.
It was no time. But it felt, and that's another thing we're going to talk about, like that perception of threat, I perceived this is the end. And I burned up all my air. And I literally, there was a moment I thought, I'm not making it to the surface. And David then got me started on sort of breath work. And I realized, I started realizing that point was that the problem I had was not in the water, the problem was in my mind.
Yeah.
And that panic, and I didn't have any tools to deal with that situation.
Right.
And so don't surf waves big enough that it's ever really a major threat.
Yeah.
But I think about some of these big wave surfers who get like pummeled by 10, 12 foot waves, and they are under for a good long while.
Right, watching the Olympics, right?
Right. Yeah. Like, I mean, holy cow.
Yeah. That's a whole nother level. Go ahead.
Well, maybe it's, so what is, we're going to talk about what is mindfulness.
Yeah.
Maybe starting with what mindfulness is not.
Yeah. I think it's a good one because when I talk with people about mindfulness, or they know that I have a practice, or I suggest that maybe the practice might be good for them to try or something, I often get a lot of pushback and I hear things that, I hear what are essentially misconceptions about it, right? So one of the big ones that I hear is that, well, I don't need to escape from the world. I don't want to escape from the world.
Right.
And that, like, it's the exact opposite of that, right? Like, mindfulness, like, well, what are you being mindful of? It's actually your present moment.
Right.
It's actually trying to engage more deeply with yourself in this moment and with the world in this moment. So, like, so that's one, right?
And you brought it up the other day in class. Like, it's not checking out.
Yeah.
It's checking in.
Right.
It's really getting curious about that present experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And likewise, like, often mindfulness comes into the conversation when we're talking about stress and anxiety.
Yep.
So people think, well, it's about rest and relaxation, so I only need to do it when I'm stressed.
Yes. Well, we kicked off the year with, you know, having Holly Rogers, right, who runs the Mindfulness Institute for Emerging Adulthood.
Yeah.
Thank you. Right.
Yeah.
And I heard someone said to me, like, well, why are we doing this in the beginning of the year? Like, we just came back from vacation, you know, essentially summer break. We should all be rested. You know, basically, let's do this when we're stressed. Right. Like, it's a waste of time to do it now. And it was like, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like a pill you take when you're like, oh, my back hurts, let me reach for my Tylenol.
Or
right?
The other day we talked about it, and through the analogy of, like, you don't fix the boat while it's sinking.
Right, right.
That's what you do when it's in port.
Yes, yes.
And essentially
totally.
We're in port.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it is a practice that builds resilience, but it is back to that deliberate practice, it is something that you have to cultivate on an ongoing basis. It doesn't have to be long. It'd be 10, 15 minutes a day, right?
Right.
But then when the situation gets busy and your environment gets stressful, you will be less reactive to the stress, right? That's part of what the research shows. You'll have better resilience. That's not the time to start it. Like, it's not a PRN medication.
Right.
Right.
And the other thing you have here on the notes, and I think this is an interesting one, that mindfulness, it's just not for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I tried it and I wasn't very good at it.
Right,
I hear that, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. or that a certain kind of person does this. Or I think it's also maybe rooted in this idea that we have to sort of pull ourselves up by the bootstraps and just muscle through a thing.
Yeah.
And if I have to meditate or practice a mindfulness, that says something about my ability to otherwise handle or deal or muscle through the stress.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, like often find with things like yoga or mindfulness that often the people who would benefit the most from it are the most resistant to trying it, right? Because it's just so far from where they are in terms of being able to relax maybe into themselves or into the moment that it's hard to do, right? And something that I think is worth mentioning, you know, this idea that, like, is it going to conflict with my religion or faith, right? Like, it does come out of a religious tradition, right? It is rooted in Buddhism, but it is, you do not have to be Buddhist to practice it in any way, right? That you have prominent people of many faiths who have very deep practices, right? So, and it's really been popularized in the U.S. As a secular version, right? Mm-hmm. So, I really enjoy the Buddhist philosophy. I think that really deepens the practice. I think you can't really do the practice without understanding some of that philosophy. But that doesn't mean you're Buddhist in a religious sense. That's a different thing.
And I would say the last one we have is sort of like, because it's focusing on the present, does that mean that planning for the future, thinking about the future, or reflecting on the past is the bad thing? And of course, it's not. Yeah. We have to do those things. I think to your point, Phil, like it's about that deliberate nature of the thinking. Like if I'm deliberately planning for the future, that's one thing. If I've just been dragged mindlessly into the future or dwelling on the past without sort of my consent, as it were, that's where we get into some trouble.
Right, right, exactly. Okay, so what is it then, right, if we're talking about what it is not?
So this quote, we can start, you brought up Jon Kabat-Zinn, well, you brought up mindfulness-based stress reduction as sort of the secular sort of more application that's come in. And Jon Kabat-Zinn was really one of the people, the powerhouses that brought mindfulness to sort of the global consciousness. And here's his definition. I define mindfulness operationally as the awareness that arises by paying attention on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally.
Yeah.
And I like that because if you break those down into the components, you get at a lot of what we've already talked about and what we're going to go into more detail about.
Yeah, paying attention. Right. So this is why I mentioned, like, I've taught cognitive psychology as a class for years, and that's why I started teaching about mindfulness, because mindfulness is a sustained attention task. That's how kind of psychologists would talk about it. And when they started doing research on people who meditate regularly, like Buddhist monks, for example, they found it like these are basically the Olympic athletes of attention. Like their ability to focus on something for an extended period of time and not be distracted by other things, they have better control over their attention than anyone else. And it's because they have a lifetime of practicing it. So that, you know, we say activity dependent neuroplasticity, which is just a fancy way of saying, you know, those areas of your brain that you use regularly, those neural pathways thicken and grow and they deepen, and that's what we see. So that's the attention part, right?
Well, and that attention is like why would that be beneficial? Why is that a problem? And think about like the world that we live in is essentially engineered to distract us.
Yeah.
Get pings and beeps and blops and bloops on our phone and all kinds of things coming in. Even the story I often tell, like it took me 10 years, 3 schools and 2 states to get through my undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. And I thought for the longest time and we could talk about this later, about sort of my identity. I identified myself as a bad student. I'm not a good reader. But really the problem was I would read, and I see this with students today who are digital natives, you know, grew up in a dopamine intoxicated world.
Yeah.
That I would read a page, I'd get distracted, I wouldn't know what I read, I had to reread it, I'd get distracted, I'd come back, read it. So what a 10-minute task was now 30 minutes, and I was frustrated. I was starting to talk poorly to myself. We'll talk about that in a second.
Right.
All this stuff. And really, it was an attention problem.
Right.
And I wish I could say that it has gone completely away. It has not. Mindfulness helped me to train that attention, that focus, such that reading is now pleasurable. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
And that you know, 20, 30 years ago, if I had said, like, one day reading will be a pleasure, I would have laughed, right?
Right. And I think, you know, just hit on one of the major themes there is that attention is trainable.
Right.
And I'd say it's trainable in both directions.
Right.
So if you're doing sustained attention tasks regularly, you are learning how to sustain your attention over longer and longer periods. If you are I'll say, scrolling, right, with these short clips, you know, that, you know, TikTok and everything else, mm-hmm. You are essentially training the exact opposite, right? You are training attention deficit.
Yep.
I think the way to think about it is we're training our attention whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
The question is, what are we training it to do? What for? So there's that. And the next part of the definition is the present moment. So mindfulness, it's like, well, mindful of what? What are you being mindful of? Now, you're being mindful of this moment. That includes your own body sensations. That's why there's often this focus on the breath, breathing in, breathing out, because that is very present focused. It's very embodied. But it could also be, you know, resting in open awareness. You know, you might be sitting outside, you know, feeling the sun on your face and looking at birds and these different things, right? So that you have this present moment.
And it's sort of a softening of that gaze. So I think we can have like a very sort of tight focus on, say, the breath.
Yeah,
But that open is also kind of a soft focus.
Yep.
To that world. And this is, speaking of dopamine, this comes from the book Dopamine Nation by Anna Lemke. Fantastic book. We'll have a list of resources at the end. This is just a beautiful quote from her. "When I look at the Milky Way galaxy in the night sky, I'm always struck by how mysterious it is that we can be part of something that looks so far away and separate. Practicing mindfulness is something like observing the Milky Way. It demands that we see our thoughts and emotions as not separate from us and yet simultaneously a part of us." Yeah. And I think that's that really touches on two things, really that interconnectivity of all things, mm-hmm. which leads to the next point, but also that observing the larger natural world and the world around us in that sort of soft focus, we see, I think, more than I think of our students a lot, like just sort of walking mindlessly across campus. So they're not really taking in the air, the sun on their skin, like moment and the environment and the world around them. They're just sort of plugging along sort of in that sort of habitual pattern.
Right. And also in that quote, I hear what's referred to as decentering, right? This kind of shifting your perspective. It's almost third person, this idea that you are, rather than being your thoughts and being your emotions, you can see your thoughts and emotions. So the analogy I really like is thought kind of as this river, you know, this stream of consciousness. And that you can't get in there and stop the stream.
Right.
But you can notice it, right? And this is, I think, for me, when I sit and try and practice, you know, seated mindfulness meditation, I'm trying to be not carried downstream with that stream of consciousness, but rather just notice it, right? And so I'm breathing in and I'm breathing out. These thoughts flow by. Occasionally, I fall in the stream. I get carried downstream. And then I'm like, oh, okay, that thought totally carried me away, right? And so that was that's me kind of connecting fully with the emotion or the thought rather than having just a little bit of distance to observe it.
And that's why I see also that paradox essentially that you're talking about, that the Milky Way is separate from us and yet simultaneously a part of us.
Yeah.
And I think that is to what you're saying also, like we so easily as humans identify a thought and emotion as us. So even in deceptive in our language, I am stressed rather than I am experiencing stressors or like that I am having an experience, but I am not that
I'm
experience.
Not stress,
I'm not the
right?
stress.
Yeah.
And being able, to your point, being able to sort of, as like the Buddhist will talk about sort of the watcher, sort of developing that sort of third person, just watching the experience, adds that little bit of distance that I can make some informed choices, decisions about that thing, whatever it is.
And to me, that's if you ask me why I did mindfulness meditation, I mean, one of the things I would say is I just feel more peaceful, right? But the other thing I would say is kind of that point you just made, informed choice. I don't want to be just a ping pong ball reacting to my thoughts and emotions as they happen. I don't want to ignore them. That's not what I'm saying, right? I want to feel them fully.
Right.
I want to experience them. And then I want to ask myself, is that what I want for the basis of my action? Mm-hmm. Right? What's my goal here? Right? Sometimes, you know, we can all do things that work against our own self-interest. Right? That's cut off your nose to spite your face saying.
Right.
So for me, what mindfulness as a practice does is it opens up space between what I think and feel and what I actually do. And it's in that space that I think free will exists.
I think about like Viktor Frankl's, maybe one of the top 100 books every human being needs to read, Man's Search for Meaning. Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust survivor. He then, after the war, turns to psychoanalysis. He talks frequently about like there's a stimulus and the response, and what you want is to make sure that gap between the two is as large as possible. When it's too close, we react. And it's often not the reaction, it's road rage, it's any kind of reaction, pulled by the thing. As soon as I can open that gap, I can make that thoughtful. And what he found, like even in those horrible, nightmarish conditions of a concentration camp, the people who survived and maybe even thrived in those conditions were the people who could say, like, I see what you're doing. I'm not going to get dragged by that. I'm going to make a different choice here. So they were having cabarets and talent contests and things in this horrific things because they were going to choose to react differently to the horrors. And you know, obviously, hopefully, we never experience anything remotely like that. But even the minor inconveniences of life can get blown out of proportion.
Yeah, right.
Road rage.
Yeah. No, it's just that I don't want to just be reacting to what happens around me because that doesn't give me any agency. And then the next part that's non-judgmentally, and I think sometimes the part that doesn't get talked about enough is these ideas of loving kindness and self-compassion. And I think this is part of where you do see the Buddhist influence, but you, of course, can find these things in Christianity and you know, I think all major religions. And the self-compassion is a huge one. Mm-hmm. If I'm stressed and I'm feeling, I may be feeling horribly sad or whatever it is, to have some self-compassion, right? And so what does that mean? I think, again, that third-person perspective, sometimes I even use the third person, like, wow, Phil is really upset today, right? Like, you know, that may sound a little bit weird, but I find that helpful to kind of put it into words and think, and this is my criteria, like, well, if I had a friend, a close friend who was experiencing this, what would I say to them? Because we often say things to ourselves about ourselves that we would never say to someone we cared about, right? And that's that kindness or non-judgmental and self-compassion. Don't beat yourself up. Don't say horrible things to yourself about yourself. You know, I'm a loser. Why'd I do that? I can't believe I did that. I'm such an idiot.
And I think that habitual thought pattern, that beating ourselves up, can be so habitual that it's almost invisible, that it's just so much a part of our psychic landscape that it's just normal life. And I think one of the benefits, and it's certainly true for me, I'm often prone to self-criticism and just beating myself up, and I would think like, oh, that's how I'm going to get better if I just push myself and I find all my flaws. But really, it just made me feel down, and it became so habitual. Prior to mindfulness, I didn't even realize how often it would creep up, even in sort of jokes, like, oh, I suck. Well, why would I even say that as a joke?
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. No, and we all do it. We all have a history of that. Yeah. I think the part of that third person distance from the mindfulness is, you know, noticing your thoughts, noticing your feelings, so you can be more deliberate about what you do, and talking about ourselves to ourselves, that's a big part of it, right? So it is compassion for those around us as well as ourselves.
Well, and I think that's a great point. Yeah, we often focus on like I want to feel better, but it's sort of like I always think about when you get on a plane, they tell you to put the oxygen mask on yourself so that you can help somebody else. By helping ourselves become more self-compassionate, it is more likely we will be more compassionate out in the world to others. So speaking of that, sort of the science,
science.
We go into at least one really powerful study. This comes from the Koru that Phil brought up. Phil, you want to take us through the study that Holly and colleagues did?
Yeah. I'll say first, just to start, right? Like there's been such an explosion of research on mindfulness meditation in neuroscience and psychology. And so at this point, it is so well researched and validated. So we're going to talk about some of the findings in general. But yeah, but to start with a specific one, because specific protocols matter in terms of practices. And this is a really good study in that it's a randomized control trial. It's what we call a waitlist control. It's kind of the gold standard for a lot of clinical research, right? So basically, you put out a call and you say, who's interested in doing this? It's a four-week mindfulness program. And in this study, they get a list of 90 people who want to do it. And they divide them in half and they say, okay, 45 of you are going to do it now. And the other 90 of you, the other 45 of you are going to do it essentially a month from now. So that's the wait list group, right? Both groups at the start, though, fill out all the same measures. And these measures were of perceived stress, sleep problems, mindfulness, and self-compassion. All right, so some of the things we've been talking about. Half the group then goes through this 4 weeks of mindfulness training. It's a very specific curriculum, right? The protocol that you follow here does matter. If you look at kind of the overall research, the meta-analyses on mindfulness, those that have kind of better definitions and more specific protocols tend to have better effects, right? They work better. So for the half that goes through this 4 week training, and you and I have not only gone through this for our own training, but we've used this to teach students as well. But then all participants take the same measures again. And what you see is for the people who did the 4 week training program, they have lower scores on perceived stress. They have fewer sleep problems at the end of the 4 weeks. They show increases in mindfulness scores just in their daily lives, meaning they're kind of more present with what they're doing. And they have higher scores in self-compassion. These differences show up in the mindfulness group, but importantly, not in the waitlist control group. These people were just hanging out. They weren't doing anything. They're just waiting for the course to begin. You don't see them. Then the study basically says, okay, the people who are on the waitlist, now it's your turn to go through this. And then they see all of those results replicate again in that group. So that is really pretty powerful. Right now, it's one study. Just to give you an example, but again, there are just thousands of studies now.
And I think what I also hear in that, one, there's a couple of things that, you know, we're talking about 4 weeks. So it's not that it's true. Like one episode, one bout of mindfulness isn't going to get you this. Yeah. Just like going to the gym once isn't going to get you a lot of fitness benefits. But 4 weeks of going to the gym, you're going to see some results. 4 weeks of mindfulness, you're going to see some results if it's consistent, deliberate practice. And that's, I think, important to call out too, that we're not saying this is just a pill, a panacea, but with practice, like, who wouldn't want, if I you did get a pill, if there was a paloxalism, that's not a, I don't know how they come up with drug names, but like, it was like 4 weeks of this treatment, you're gonna have all these benefits. Like, it would make billions. And here's something that you don't need anything other than yourself to do, and you could get all of these incredible benefits. Yeah.
And I think this ties into one of the misconceptions earlier. It's not for me, because often people try it once or twice and they're like, I didn't get anything out of that. It didn't work. Right.
Yeah, right.
But it's not supposed to, like, the research does show that you need at least 3 weeks and more typically four of 10 to 15 minutes a day is around what the research shows to show an actual effect. Right. Mm. If you do that, if you engage in the practice for a month, you should see decreases in stress. You should be sleeping better. You should be more engaged in what you're doing day to day. You should have more self-compassion and compassion for others, right? So, but it does. And even a lot of pills that you would take, medications, some of them take 3 or 4 weeks to have their impact as well, right? So this shouldn't be shocking, right? But it is important. Like, I get people, you know, we get this with some of our students who maybe they don't fully buy into it, and so they never practice, and they say, see, it didn't work.
Right.
Well, you never gave it a chance. You have to be willing to buy in for at least those 4 weeks, and, you know, and then make your judgment. But if you don't try, it's self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right. We're not going to go into detail on all of these other benefits, but that we thought just to make a list here, just lowers anxiety, mindfulness literature showing lowers anxiety and depression, probably through a process called cognitive reappraisal. I don't know if you want to say anything specifically about that, Phil.
Yeah, it's you might also call it reframing, right? In that we have these narratives we tell ourselves sometimes about ourselves, right? I'm not no good at something, or and being able to kind of notice that and then question it. Well, am I really no good at anything, right? Am I really worthless, or whatever it is that you're telling yourself? that kind of reappraisal thing helps us break, you know, you mentioned earlier, these things just become habitual and we don't even know we're doing them. And so how do you break that pattern? Well, you have to notice it first and then you have to reappraise. So that's essentially the cognitive reappraisal.
Increases subjective well-being, increases self-regulation, emotional regulation, meta-awareness, sustained attention, which we talked about, distress tolerance, which is big for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of. So do you want to, what is distress tolerance, right?
So, you know, what we often see with young people, and it's certainly true for folks our age too, is that feeling that any crisis starts to feel overwhelming. So I don't have sort of a tolerance to discomfort or distress or whatever. We can, you know, hammer out what kind of word we want to use, but that inability to be uncomfortable. And so we've talked about this sort of engineered world. Our world has also been engineered to be very comfortable. And it's our human inclination to gravitate to comfort. We don't want to expel energy. We don't want to do those things. We, as evolutionary biologists would say, we evolved to conserve energy, right? So if a world has been engineered to make that more possible, it's really easy to fall into those kinds of traps. But this ability to, again, to Phil's point about sort of intentional choice, about deliberate autonomy over my, I can choose to go to the hard thing, whether that's a workout, whether that's a, you know, when we go to our retreat, we often go rappelling down waterfalls. I am terrified of heights.
Yeah, right.
And it is a moment for me to just breathe through and be present with all those feelings. I'm not necessarily going to push those, I can't push those feelings away, but I can choose to do this activity, breathe through it, practice this, and I have so much fun. But, and our students will say, like, I wouldn't have necessarily done that on my own, but I'm so glad I did. And so how we can tolerate those discomfort, uncomfortable situations more.
Yeah, and I think, and related to that, a lot of uncomfortable conversations.
Right, totally.
Right, yep. We often avoid having uncomfortable conversations because they make us uncomfortable, but we often need to if we're going to communicate effectively with people around us. You know, so that, again, that distress tolerance, sometimes to achieve whatever your goals are, you need to think about difficult things and work through them. As they say in trauma, the only way out is through.
Right.
You can't run away from it. It's not effective. And then another big kind of thing that comes up in the research, this is one of the biggest things, is decreased activation of what's known as the default mode network. It's called the default mode network because when they were initially doing research on people in scanners and fMRIs, and they basically said, you know, don't do anything, just hang out while we check on the equipment, they noticed this kind of same area of the brain always on during whatever, what they're supposed to be, no task, right? And so they're like, what's going on here? And it turns out this default mode network is really a lot of kind of self-referential thought. So, you know, at some level, this is rumination. You might also think of it as stuck in your head.
Yep.
And so one of the things I like about breathing and that I have enjoyed about yoga and Tai Chi is that it can bring me out of my head into the present moment, into my body. Right. So I'm not kind of stuck in these self-referential loops of like, oh, I need to do this. And did I do this other thing? And what did that person mean when they said this thing to me? Right. All these kind of self-referential things that can just spin us out of control.
So we're nearly out of time. Maybe we could save the stress response when we talk about sort of doing hard things.
Yeah.
And because I think there's way more, I don't want to shortchange that conversation.
Well, this is, let's call this mindfulness part one, because we want to do the how-to, right?
Right, right.
And so for part two, we can pick up and we can talk about the body stress response, which I think is really essential for understanding the how-to part, right? Mm. To understand what's happening, this idea of zone of optimal functioning. And then we can kind of walk through some basic practices and provide some resources so that if you do want to start a practice, if this is something new to you, you've got some place to go.
And we can link some of the practice to what's going on, like why is this happening?
Yeah.
And talk physiologically, psychologically about what exactly is going on when I do this practice, perhaps, maybe. So maybe in our last minutes, we do want to talk about, you know, situations, people for whom mindfulness might not be a good option.
This comes up Not a whole lot in the literature, but enough where it deserves some attention. We're talking about the research. Are there people where it might actually be harmful? And first I'll say this is a complicated topic and it does need more research on it. In a lot of these studies, part of their exclusion criteria for participating in the study is that you don't have kind of suicidal ideations or any kind of diagnosed psychiatric disorders, and particularly related to suicidal ideation, sometimes a history of trauma, the mindfulness can be triggering, right? For lack of a better word. I think with the trauma component, part of it, you know, if there's a history of trauma that you have not worked through, your body might essentially be stuck in this high stress response level. And asking you to tune in to how your body is feeling can be very uncomfortable, because part of what you may have learned to do to survive is to dissociate some from those experiences, right? And the messages your body is telling you.
There's a great book. I don't have the author in front of me. The Body Keeps the Score.
Yeah.
Which is really, I can't remember the author's name off the top of my head, but he talks a lot about, like, you know, focusing on your physical sensations may be the trigger that causes an episode or causes you to spiral out. Like that might not be a good practice for certain individuals.
Right,
for
sure. Right. And so, yeah, it's definitely worth mentioning. And for anyone teaching mindfulness, right. You know, I try and be mindful of that, right? And bring that up with
and even something as similar. We, you know, in our practices with students, we often say, like, close your eyes if you're comfortable, soften your gaze, because even just closing your eyes could be a triggering or cause you to focus on different things that might not get you one where they want to go.
Yeah, and I've always had at least a few students who have said, like, you know, well, focusing on my breath really makes me feel anxious, right? It triggers a panic attack. When you lead mindfulness, it's good to, again, invite, right? Don't tell. And then also offer alternatives. So if focusing on your breath isn't comfortable for you, what else might you do?
Yep.
Right.
We're going to include some resources with this. And again, as Phil said, we're going to have at least a part two, maybe part trace.
Yeah.
That's it for this episode. If you have questions or comments or there's a subject you'd like to hear us discuss, please reach out to ThriveologyLab@gmail.com. And we will one day have a mailbag episode.
That's right. All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Phil.
Thrive on.
Thrive on. I love that.